So, have you heard of EVP, Mr. Rivers?
No.
I'm not surprised. I mean, those that have cause cracks. EVP stands for Electronic Voice Phenomenon.
I'm listening.
Well, I'm not a clairvoyant. I'm not a medium. I don't contact the dead. The dead contact me.
I'm Darren.
And we are the Rants Macabre, now a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit Fangoria.com.
I'm a skeptic. I'm an atheist who will always lean towards science. That said, I think what we don't know, what we don't understand, far outweighs what we do. Do you want to weigh in on where you fall?
Well, yeah. Okay, so I too am an atheist, but I leave room for things that I can't explain or things that maybe we just don't have a handle on. So, yeah.
And it's fun to think about because it's scary.
Exactly. It is very scary. If someone gives me a suggestion, I'll go along for the ride. That's the kind of person I am, so...
You're a skeptic, not a cynic.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it.
Yeah.
Because I'll think about it, and I think there's lots of things. I think it would be selfish for people to think that we know everything there is to know.
Philosophers used to think that man was the only animal that could laugh, and that separated us from the creatures was representative of us having a soul. But it turns out if you tickle mice and record it, then amplify it and pitch it down, you can totally hear them laugh. So technology made that possible. So who's to say what we're missing with our limited senses? So EVP stands for electronic voice phenomenon. It's the recording of sounds or communications inaudible to the human ear. And I've seen TV shows of ghost hunters and spirit chasers who do EVP recordings and then infer and wildly speculate as to what they think they've got.
Yeah.
It's generally ridiculous, and I promise we will do no such thing.
So I've got my handy Zoom 5 that we use to record all our podcasts, but instead of our plugged-in SM57-58, we're going to use the top-mounted stereo mic to capture the environment. So, Mindy, why are we headed to the basement of your building?
Okay, so in my building, I'll start with the backstory really quick. Mm-hmm. I always got a creepy feeling in the elevator, okay? And this has been since I very first moved into this
your
building.
Your elevator sounds like a spaceship. We're going to
It's terrifying. And it's an old building, whatever. But there's this downstairs basement where you throw, like, big garbage away. And I would always, like, go down there and go really, really fast and drop whatever I had to do and then, like, run back to the elevator. And I always get this terrible, terrible feeling. And then at... this year in March and April, signs around the neighborhood started getting posted, and it was for an unsolved crime that had happened in our neighborhood. So, you know, like, I took a picture of it, I showed my husband, I said, this is weird, look at the address of this place. And here's what the poster said, but obviously it won't leave my address in there because stalkers. Here's what the poster said: $2,000 reward for homicide. On March 28th, 1996, at approximately 3 p.m. inside of this building, in the confines of the 114th Precinct in Queens, Eileen Lawlor, who is pictured above, was found stabbed to death in her basement apartment. And it's an unsolved crime, still to this day, and they were looking for anyone who might know something. So they had posted pictures and posters 19 years later.
Okay, and there's no actual basement apartment there now.
Here's the thing, right? So I don't know, but there's always like laundry drying down there.
Okay.
So I don't know whose that is if no one lives down there. It's very weird. The other thing is, and this is all stuff that I had discovered before I found out about this. So it was always scary. Then I found out a lady was murdered there. And there was this knife when we first moved in, and it was there for about a year, that was, like, kind of jammed into these electrical cords. It was, like, a broken kitchen knife, like a, not like a Yikes. Butter knife, like a steak knife,
yeah.
Jammed into these electrical cords, and we thought, oh, that's how they do electricity in Queens. This is just how we fix things. And then later we discover this woman was stabbed to death. And she was stabbed to death actually so violently by her attacker that what got him to quit stabbing her was that the knife broke actually in her neck. And that's why he stopped stabbing her. So then, like, we discovered this again years later, but when we first came here, there was a broken knife jammed into the electrical stuff downstairs.
It was a frightening combination of things to find.
Yeah.
So let's start at the beginning. Really, the reason we wanted to do this episode is that White Noise is a pretty dope movie. So
right.
2005 brought us White Noise, directed by Geoffrey Sachs. He's an Englishman.
Fancy name.
Both he and the writer hadn't made much horror at all and haven't since, really.
Which is, I think White Noise, the first one, is a really good, fun, scary movie.
I think, yeah, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, but I think for the script that they had, he knocked it out of the park. Mm-hmm. I think I kind of wish it was a more interesting story to tell, but in terms of like matching the visuals, I thought it was fantastic. So it was written by Niall Johnson, also English. And just one note that Sachs made something that I kind of want to see if I can find, but something called the Van Helsing Chronicles.
Oh, I might like that.
It was a made-for-TV movie.
Oh, now I like it less, I don't, but we'll see.
So Michael Keaton is the face of the movie.
Right.
And at the time, he had kind of like taken some breaks from acting.
Yeah, at that time, you weren't really hearing about him. Like now, you know, he's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, he popped up in The Other Guys, where he was really funny. After that, he was in Birdman, which was outstanding. He was really great in that.
So it was good to see him in this, like seeing it now.
Yeah.
You know, like seeing Michael Keaton now versus at that time, it was Michael Keaton out of the blue. And I think I might have said something like, oh, Batman.
Right. It's really strange that that is my association with him. The 89 Batman.
Yeah.
Like, he's just etched in my memory between that and Beetlejuice. Like, I...
See, and I always go for Batman even over Beetlejuice for him. When I think of Michael Keaton, it's
Well,
Batman.
You get more of his face. I mean, I think you probably appreciate that, like, the amount of stretching in terms of acting that he did for Beetlejuice.
He's often overlooked.
I would say so. And the irony, like, he's a very everyman looking fella. Like, he can do creepy really well. There was a movie called Desperate Measures, which was terrible, but he was a villain and he was upsetting.
Like, I think he could do a good villain. Yeah. He could be a creepster for sure.
Yeah. But in this one, he's meant to play family man.
And
he's,
you feel bad for him. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I listened to the director's commentary, and before I looked it up on IMDb, it was shot in Canada. So that's kind of, it's a good looking movie. I think maybe you're supposed to assume it's the Pacific Northwest.
I guess.
It could be Seattle. He lives on this weird, like,
beautiful
alcove.
House. Like, he's loaded, obviously.
Yeah. He's an architect, and his wife is a famous author.
But even, and my husband said, and I noticed it, when you go to his architect office, it's like someone said, this is how these things are supposed to look.
It actually was an architecture firm.
Really?
Yeah.
Because we were like, this seems like this is how this should look, but I have no idea of what that should be. So.
I don't either. But yeah, they talk about it on the director's commentary that they had like half a day to shoot that stuff because, you know, it was a working office.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about the phenomenon of white noise a little bit.
Okay, the EVP phenomenon you're talking about?
Yes, specifically the EVP.
Okay.
So in the intro to the movie, there's a couple pieces on the screen that explain the phenomenon and are supposed to sort of acclimate the viewer to what you can expect to see. It talks about the signals from detuned appliances, so a radio with an antenna or a television getting white noise.
Yeah.
But I think the inherent problem with the idea of EVP is that, like, any kid who ever tuned TV antennas knows that there's a lot of bleed between signals. And, I mean, given any kid who tuned a television is dead from old age by now.
Yeah, right. It's true.
But I remember the days. And, I mean, even, like, scrambled porn and that whole, like, teenage thing, like, that exists because signals are kind of blended in
there.
I'll
tell you how much of a nerd I was. I had a TV with like rabbit ears when I was little because I couldn't have a nice TV. And, you know, we just had like two TVs and I was the
remote control for my family.
Yeah, exactly. So I used to watch Jeopardy on the Scrambled Channel.
On the Scramble Channel.
Yeah, because we didn't have cable. We only had the rabbit ears. That's all we had. So it was on channel like ABC or something. And that was like, you could only get Fox, NBC, and CBS. But Jeopardy was on the other channel. So I had to watch it scrambled. And that's how, like, I would be, little kid Mindy would be sitting there watching scrambled TV. But it wasn't porn. It was Jeopardy.
It's so dirty.
It's so sad.
So I have to imagine the phenomena is kind of dying away. I mean, these days you see it on ghost shows because they take a digital recorder out.
Right.
But like in the days of digital television, that's all gone away.
Right, right.
Oh, and so this was another thing that very early on, it's actually in the opening credits, they show his like kind of 90s style boombox in the kitchen.
Yes.
And it's got the tape player and record. And, you know, in those days, people were making tapes from CDs.
Right, right.
And that's what he's got in the kitchen. It's also got a radio. Of course it does. But again, the phenomenon of recording just room noise and then playing it back. I don't know if you ever did this, but when I used to make mixtapes.
Aw.
The speakers can feed in audio. And it's actually something that, it's funny, I know this because like in the early days of hip hop, when they didn't have microphones, they could just plug headphones into the recording jack and receive a signal from, I think it's the left earphone.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it has to do with the sort of the magnets at work being the same ones that are in microphones.
Fair
and
enough.
If you sort of reverse engineer it. So I don't really buy that like it's picking up, I don't know, spirit world stuff. I think it's just like it might be signals in the air, but essentially the speakers become, you know, microphones.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't want to shit on it too much. And okay, so let's suspend disbelief.
Yeah.
And
well,
dive
I mean,
in.
There, you know, there's a lot that has been said about EVP though. And it's not that I want to discount it or discredit that, because there's actually like a formal association that has to do with EVP.
The AAEVP.
Well, now it's called like A-Trans-C, which they probably need to rethink that. But it's that's what it's called now. And I mean, there's been a lot of work done on it. I don't always hear what they claim to hear.
Right, at that
but
point.
I'm not going to like shit on it because people spend a lot of their time, I think, trying to do this particular thing.
Yeah. There's a dynamic to the movie. And so one of the main characters, Raymond Price, played by the character actor Ian McNeice, is someone who like wants to help, is not, you know, you kind of believe him that he's skeptically inclined, but he's come upon this technology and he talks about, and this is where it gets like emotional and dramatic, but that he lost his son at a young age and he was suicidal. And through EVP, he's collected messages from his son, and it's meant the world to him.
Yeah.
And so that's the same kind of thing that you get from like the Long Island Medium and those like TV shows where people are like, I just want to know that they're my dead relative's at rest and they're happy. So I get that it's a comfort to people, but it's still kind of a scam, a sham. I don't know. But yeah, in any case, his character is what's the word I'm looking for? Endearing?
Yeah, I guess he's endearing.
Yeah.
You feel bad for him. He's just trying to help out.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, at no point does he, like, ask for Michael Keaton's credit card number or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't think he charges.
He doesn't seem to, no.
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure that out. I was thinking, like, if he charged for his services, then I would feel differently about it.
Yeah.
But because it's free and he seems to be doing it out of the goodness of his heart, you know, whatever. But we're introduced to him, though, because Michael Keaton loses his wife.
Yeah, she goes missing initially.
Yes. Yeah.
And it looks like it might have been,
she slipped on a rock and fell into the river.
Was like trying to change a tire by the side of the road and maybe was sort of pushed off the side by a scare or something like that. But that much is left vague.
Right.
But you never give up hope, ever. It's the only way to get by.
And he's even skeptical that she's gone because, sorry, what's the character's name?
Raymond Price.
Because Raymond comes to him before any news has actually come from the cops about whether or not she's dead or alive.
Right.
And Michael Keaton doesn't want to think that she's possibly dead, but eventually, whatever, he leaves his card.
Yes.
That was nice of him. And yeah, so when they do start working together, you get the full immersion to EVP.
Right.
And
it seems like Mr. Price is kind of obsessed with this.
And with EVP, I can hear them, I can see them and I can record them.
Everybody who, I mean, we watch Michael Keaton go on sabbatical, like call his office and say, I'm not going to be around for a while. And then just like dedicate all his money to like TVs blaring white noise and recording equipment.
Ignoring or neglecting his son.
That was so sad.
Yeah, I felt really bad for that. That was like, dial it back, Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
You're a dick.
His little kid was cute and like a good enough actor that like there is the really eerie moment where the kid, I guess he's maybe getting up in the morning to go to like get breakfast and the kitchen table is gone.
Yeah.
And he's like, where, and it's in the dining room. It's got more TVs.
Exactly.
And VCRs set up on it. And he goes, where are we going to eat? He goes, on our laps.
And you're like, great, Dad. That's great.
That's parenting 101.
Daddy.
Yeah.
Are you going to be okay?
On the commentary, Sachs, the director, talked about his use of silence in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I guess I kind of noticed this. The first pass I watched this, I was wearing headphones.
Okay.
And so when they're versions of white noise, you do notice. And Sachs does this thing where he will play up like a refrigerator hum in mm-hmm. the room. He sort of plays with what silence actually is. And at times he drops out everything.
Okay.
And like those might be the moments leading up to a scare or some, you know, sort of cops knocking at his front door, that kind of thing. But I thought that was very cool. There are a couple different moments where trees blowing in the wind might sort of supply the white noise. His new apartment has a waterfall outside of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that contributes to the white noise in the background. So there's variations on silence. And I thought that was kind of cool, especially that it sort of, sometimes it announces that a ghost is coming.
Yeah, it makes me kind of bummed out. I mean, I thought the scares were excellent in this film, like mm-hmm. really, really great. It just makes me bummed out that I just got rid of my surround sound. And
oh, yeah?
So I'm just using a bar on my TV now. And okay. So now I'm like, oh, now maybe I wish I would have had the surround and had a little better sound system. But so it seems like there's these bad guys seemingly following Michael Keaton. And when they show up, or when any ghost people show up, there's like flickering lights and shenanigans.
Yeah, they like to announce themselves.
Yeah, it's so they don't sneak up on you, which I appreciate. Like, if you were haunting me, please don't sneak up on me. I don't like it. Don't do it. There's a point in the beginning where he gets a phone call. Not at the beginning. This is towards the beginning. He gets a phone call from his dead wife's phone.
Yeah, when he's in, like, the sub-basement. He's working on a building. He's an architect. They get stuck in the basement.
And he sees her number. Then he later finds the phone and still gets the phone call from it.
Yeah.
I was wondering, like, would you answer that phone call?
Hell yes.
Yeah, I would, too. Seems like the thing to do, but then at the same time,
not to. No?
Yeah, but what if it's not her? And also in this day and age, someone could just clone the phone number.
In all fairness, I pick up the phone regardless if I recognize the phone number or not.
Ah, like, I see. I'm not always one of those.
I talk to a lot of automated recordings.
You do talk to a lot of robots every day.
I'm willing to talk to anyone. I'm so low.
Oh, it's so sad. But I liked it. I liked that idea of that phone call. And it reminded me of the Stephen King short story, it's like New York Times at bargain prices or something like that, where the dead husband calls 5 years later and is talking to her from Grand Central. And so she's on this phone call with her dead husband.
Okay.
And it's a really great story. It's like 3.5 pages long, but it's like a really great story. So I was like, it reminded me of that, the phone call from the dead.
Cool. It's kind of like Frequency, the Dennis Quaid movie where he's sort of talking through time. It's a good flick.
It's a really good movie.
I think it's Disney.
I don't know.
It might actually be Disney, which is weird because
it's Dennis Quaid, not Bill Paxton.
Yes.
Damn it.
I have a note about the psychic in the movie. I really like that scene. So at this point, Michael Keaton has gone whole hog into like the recording and listening. But then to sort of round out the bases, he does go to see the psychic. And they made her blind for some reason.
I think because it's like an old timey idea that mediums would be blind.
I guess. And for a movie all about audio. Well, there's actually a lot of TV white noise. But okay, so the audio is kind of the crucial communication medium. So I thought she was going to be a sham because she very through the like paint by number style in terms of a psychic going from very vague general points and then sort of recognizing your facial expressions and your, you know, what you're agreeing to and what not. And then she gets more specific from there.
Right. Except for what she's specific on, he thinks has nothing to do with anything.
Because she says
Willow Avenue and he's like, nope, that doesn't mean anything to me.
Right.
You know, but she was dead on.
And then when she gets the flash.
It's electronic voice.
Yeah, I know what this is.
Well, I've been making these tapes.
Yeah, you know, you shouldn't be trying this by yourself. It's not safe. It's like homemade Ouija boards and teenage seances at Halloween. EVP is not good. You have to understand that we spend years developing our relationships with our guides so that we can protect you.
From what?
From the ones who like damage. Because they are out there and they will find you. If you're gonna keep doing this, if you insist on meddling, then...
Anna, my wife, she sent me a sign. I just...
No, not Anna. You are misreading everything. Listen to me, it is one thing to contact the dead. It is another thing to meddle, and you are meddling.
And I love that moment where, like, shit just got real.
Yeah.
And she has a big issue with him meddling with EVP and, like, gives him a stern talking to about messing with spirits without having... the like framework, or I mean, she almost puts it like an education. Like she went to psychic night school,
right.
I'm accredited, and you're just an amateur
fucking around.
Yeah,
I even wrote in my notes like, if you scare a medium, that's like really bad news.
I love those moments though. Yeah,
because when that person should have seen everything. I mean, even though she's blind.
Yeah, it's funny that I guess it did take her a while to like have that sit in. Maybe it's just I don't know. It's like you gotta. It's like a push start to a car. Like you got to be in the mode receiving things because she eventually does get very specific.
Right. And correct about everything.
Yeah. But that was great. I love that she tells him that like, it's none of it is what you think it is.
Right.
As a character piece, you do kind of watch him fall apart, but I did appreciate that. Like you kind of recognize the stages where he goes from like being completely skeptical and maybe these mirror the sort of stages of grief, but he goes from being completely skeptical and denying to wanting to believe to committing and then like trying to tell other people. So when he goes to the husband who
He saves the baby, lets the wife die.
But the wife, she dies. And the husband isn't having it for a second.
Right.
And, like, here's a guy who, you know, one might say, like, you owe him a couple minutes of your time to listen to what he's got to say.
He saved your baby out of a car.
Yeah, but the moment Michael Keaton starts talking about, like, your wife contacted me before the accident.
Uh-huh.
He's just like, you shut your fucking mouth. Like, he's
that was
like
a really strong reaction that I was unclear about. But I think, like, some people react that way to scary shit or paranormal things. People are just shut down and are angry about it.
I am grateful for what you did, Mr. Rivers. I really am. My son wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So thank you. But now, I'd like you to leave us alone.
No, Mr. Black Eye.
Carol may have believed your bullshit, but not me. So you and your sick friends, you stay the fuck away from me and my family. You understand? You stay away.
It was a PG-13 movie. That was the only fuck in the movie. That's why they got away.
Wow.
Well, that's the one they got away with. I mean, on that note, that woman that dies in the car accident where he saves the baby.
Right.
That was like a preemptive. And that's kind of the transition that the movie makes. I wasn't wild about the shift in dynamic where he goes from listening to spirits who've already moved on.
Right.
To seemingly people going to die and those sort of flashes. I
was confused why Raymond Price never got.
Oh, but he did because he talked to his wife before she actually passed.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, they find that out once they're looking at his logs.
Like, Raymond had done this for 23 years, and I feel like if the ghost people were going to come out and get you, they would have gotten him before 23 years. It was since Michael Keaton's only been doing this for 3 months?
Yeah, apparently he's really good at it. I mean, he commits to like a 24-hour schedule. He's even listening in the car.
Yeah. Oh, I also made a note about that. I was like, don't listen to EVP and drive. That was my note on that. The lesson there is don't listen to EVP and drive.
No cell phones, no EVP recordings.
No.
It's funny, I talked about the audio, but the cinematography, and up top we talked about how the director really nailed it. I kind of I wish the story was a little more dynamic, but in terms of the visuals, for a very cheap movie, it was great looking. And there's a lot of camera movement, but it's all kind of, it's dynamic and subtle at the same time. And I really like that, especially, you know, I wasn't wild about the ending, but I will say it looked awesome.
Did you ever see this before? Before this?
I've seen bits and pieces.
Okay. Because I remember watching this in college and I liked it.
Okay.
So I was like, God, I hope it still stands up.
Yeah.
You know, like 10 years later or whatever.
Especially, well, you watched this one and then part two?
I watched, yeah.
Recently?
Yeah. Okay. I watched them in White Noise 1 first, then White Noise 2.
Okay. So
recently.
I watched part two first. And that sort
and I
of,
had never seen part two.
That raised the bar for what part one was going to have to make up for.
And I will say that you poisoned the well. Like, when I went to watch White Noise 2, you really poisoned the well for me. And
I at first I
was like, it's not that bad. At first I was like, Darren's being a dick. It's not that bad. And then I was like, oh my God, no, this is bad.
Yeah, everything was accurate. I was sort of trying to temper your expectations and... you know, giving you leeway to have fun with it. So you don't expect it to be something it's not, which is to say good.
Yeah, it is. It is not good.
Okay, so let's transition. Oh, well, so I don't know. That's my last note on White Noise is the idea that the less skeptical you are, the better this movie is. Mm-hmm. And I think you can probably say that about most movies. But in this case, like, I don't know. I did have to tone it down and just kind of enjoy the process.
Yeah, but I liked it, and I thought the scares were awesome. Like, the scares were scary.
Yeah, the lady in the box.
Yeah.
Was the first, like, on-screen scare, and that I loved.
I thought it was really, really great. I really liked it. I liked the three guys, the three ghost guys.
Yeah. And I mentioned before, I thought that was a missed opportunity that they were. And I kind of appreciated that, like, no need to explain. They're just like, it's a darkness that is beyond you.
Right. And people just don't know.
Yeah. And I thought it would have been cool to sort of reintroduce them in part two.
Right.
Part two is a different animal entirely.
I was kind of wanting to know more about them or a backstory or I don't anything but what we got in White Noise 2.
I mean, it's just, it's kind of a, it's a unique idea that, like, you occasionally get, like, killers in tandem.
Right.
But, like, when do you get three?
Right.
So, like, three guys who...
Well, I mean, but then you have Trinity. I mean, that's the idea is, I think, you know, you have that idea of Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Mm-hmm. I mean, things travel, powerful things travel in three, always traveling in
and
three.
And actually, part two does kind of play up the biblical elements.
Okay, so... We've kind of looked up the respectful way to ask these questions, and so...
We hope we're being respectful.
Yeah, I mean, hoping that respect makes a difference between being followed back by a ghost.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that.
Okay. Okay. I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy.
It's like the podcast over.
I know. And we are the Rance Macabre.
Okay. All right, so we'll switch off. Is there anyone in this basement with us?
That was the elevator noise. You have to tell when there's a thing on EVP.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be looking at the waveforms, but okay.
Are you Eileen?
There was water running. What year were you born?
Do you have any family?
Do you know what year it is?
Do you know about the knife that's now sitting on top of the electric box?
Does the knife mean something to you?
Is there anything you want us to know?
Have spoken with us here, we will consider what you said, but please do not follow us back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I was very tempted to like throw in something for you to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening as much as I could. I was really trying to focus and listen, but I think all we discovered is like, that's just the noisiest basement ever with all the banging and clanging.
A lot of machines at work, a lot of pipes running water. I mean, it was a basement. There was probably
an incinerator.
30 apartments in that building. How many do you figure?
It goes up to M on each floor.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Okay. So could you tell that I was really nervous asking the questions?
Yeah. I mean, like that's the thing with stuff like this is like, it's probably not anything, but at the same time there's a hint that like maybe
that was my mood editing it. When I was listening to it, I was like, please don't let there be a fucking noise.
You kind of like shit all over like the idea of EVP, but then when you finally went to listen to it, there was a part of you that believes in it, because if you were scared, there is a part of you.
Sure. I'm not closed to any particular thing. I'm not such a cynic or a skeptic that I'm going to like deny something that's obvious.
Right.
That's why I was praying there was no noise that I needed to decipher. There was a very quiet, it sounded more like a breath, and that's probably what it was. But towards the end, I thought maybe that was something, but it was so quiet and so vague that I didn't bump up the audio already. Yeah.
Could you see it on the sound file?
No.
Okay.
No. So what we listened to was a heavily compressed version. So like all the quietest noises were jammed up really loud, and our voices were compressed down. So I don't know. I mean, we gave it a shot. We were open to the idea.
I kind of hoped a little bit, but then I was like you, where I was like, I really hope nothing. But then at the same time, like maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm definitely glad I don't live there now. You know, because like that's all I
Me
need.
Me too, because that was a bitch to get out to.
Yeah, right. We're in our new recording location. All right. Well, 2 years later, White Noise 2 comes out because we needed a sequel and we asked for one, right? Or something. I don't think anyone ever asked for it, but we got it. And we got it with Nathan Fillion in the starring role.
Who I typically love. I follow on Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a huge Firefly fan. So, you know, in my eyes, he wasn't the problem with the movie.
Yeah, no, I don't think it was Nathan Fillion that we could blame for this. So he gets a pass there. But see, I know him from Buffy, not Firefly. So I kind of hate him a little bit because of his character from Buffy.
Okay.
Like he really sucks. Hate him.
So, yeah, it was directed by Patrick Lussier, who is mostly known for being an editor. And his editing reel includes tons of great stuff, including the remake of My Bloody Valentine, Apollo 18, and a lot of other horror stuff. But he doesn't direct that much.
But he just missed the boat on this one.
Yeah, I mean,
the CG was terrible. Green screen, terrible.
They really relied on the special effects, and I didn't think they needed to.
They didn't need to because they didn't have the money to have good special effects. So they needed to tell the story instead of showing me shenanigans.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was written by Matt Veen. And I don't have anything on him.
Oh, okay.
So a quick synopsis. Following the loss of his family, a man attempts suicide only to discover upon waking that he can identify people who are about to die.
Right.
Wake up, listener. You fell asleep during that. I know.
Here's how I started my notes with it. A very what the fuck opening. I'm into this. I started off so optimistic.
it opens trying to establish him as like a family guy who right. you like, and when all this goes sour, you're gonna feel really bad for him.
And but you do, because what happens? His wife and kid gets killed.
It's so
in one
awful.
Of the most fucked up ways that you can imagine. Like, I mean, you just can't even imagine something. It was really awful.
Yeah. So okay. So we've said they die.
It's fine. We can tell them.
Okay. So a complete stranger.
Yep.
Arrives at the diner where him and his son, who's like nine,
something,
and his
yeah.
wife, both of which are kind of having like a very gentle seizure. Like something's
yeah,
wrong.
Yeah, they're having what I think like my grandma would call like an episode.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what She's, that means, but
vapors.
I think that's, yeah.
So they're freaking out initially, and that catches his attention.
Mm-hmm. Okay, buddy?
I don't feel so good.
And then the stranger rolls up, draws a gun, shoots them both, like just about runs out of bullets, except he saves one for himself and puts it in his mouth. And it's a PG-13 movie, so it happens off yeah. camera.
I'm so sorry.
It's all happening in slow motion. And Nathan Fillion just kind of got a what the fuck look on his face the whole time because
yeah.
what?
Yeah, exactly. Then that's why I wrote that, because it was a whole like the whole scene was just like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So you expect it's going to make sense eventually. And they do sort of go into just what happened and why. But for a long while, you're just kind of like, well, that was a horrible thing to happen to
right.
one human being.
It seems like a really random, awful thing.
Yeah. And so I never really connected with him as like family guy and felt, I don't know. So when he like spirals and gets down with the booze and the pills,
yeah.
I was just kind of like, eh.
Yeah,
he's
me
watching
too.
old videotapes, and the whole time I'm still thinking, like, I know I'm supposed to care, but I don't.
But I don't seem to. Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
So when he swallows, you know, a bottle full of pills and mm-hmm. washes it down with whiskey, I think he left his outgoing voicemail message that was, like, essentially a suicide note.
Yes, he did, which was very clever, I thought. Like, oh. I mean, clever on his part. Like, if I was a person, I don't know,
but
I guess.
That doesn't strike you as more of a plea for help, a cry for help, because someone could hear that, as they did, someone important to him heard it and went over there and saved him.
Well, we
suicide
all know
note, you
attempted
keep,
suicide's
like,
a cry for help.
I'm just saying, if he was committed, he would have, like, written a note, put it in his pocket, let someone find it after the work has been done.
But what are the odds someone's going to call, like, while you're... I don't know. Maybe
don't
he's
know.
Very popular. I don't know.
He just lost his family. Someone's probably going to check in on him.
It's probably true.
Someone's probably showing up with a casserole.
Yeah, that's nice. Can't get enough casseroles. But then so he's watching TV during this beginning thing. And I thought to myself, does static even exist anymore on TV?
Not with digital television, no.
Right. So, I mean, it's just kind of
weird. So
that's
one phenomenon like, that's going to go away.
Yeah. Sorry, EVP. I can't watch you on my TV.
So considering he tries to commit suicide and nearly gets it right to the point, I mean, when they talk about this movie being called White Noise 2, The
right.
Light.
The Light.
They're referring to the white light that people see during near-death experiences.
Right.
And, like, you can read into spiritual elements, but my understanding is that it's your synapses dying.
Yeah,
so the
exactly.
common effect is just your brain shutting down on account of no oxygen going
Fair
to
enough.
It.
Sure.
You knock on, it's the lamp.
We're losing him.
Asystole.
Checking for respirations.
In this case, it's a pipeline to heaven, and he sees his wife and son, and then they shock him with
the
paddles,
worst,
and he comes back.
The worst effect ever.
It,
I mean,
yeah.
that's when I finally was like, CG sort of tunnel to the light. Terrible scene transition. Oh, then the CG tunnel where he gets then pulled back.
Yeah.
Then he also, there's a terrible scene transition from Nathan Fillion's face to the x-ray. It's like the worst thing ever. Like so much that I had to note it down very specifically.
Yeah. And I think when he's like falling backwards back into his body, it's like a weird CG like brain scan of synapses firing.
Yeah, I don't
it's,
even know what I'm looking at. It looks like I'm walking
like,
through a briar patch. It's
yeah.
confusing.
This whole movie kind of has a sci-fi channel feel to
Ugh,
it.
It was terrible.
But that said, when he comes to, it seems like a couple days later,
yeah.
They've completely disregarded that he tried to kill himself.
Yeah, no one seems to be too concerned with him trying to kill himself, which I think, like, people should be watching him for a while, right?
Yeah, and I thought this movie is, like, pretty obviously filmed in Canada, and I don't know. Maybe you could extrapolate
Canada, they don't care.
Maybe so few people are upset and not happy that they don't have the infrastructure to deal with depression.
That could be.
Just kidding, Canada. We obviously love you, and we're envious of your healthcare system.
Yes, it's true. That's why we can't imagine that anyone would be so sad they would want to kill themselves.
Of course. But so his doctor, his weird punk rock doctor, right, is named Dr. Karras, which is specifically a reference to The Exorcist.
Hello, Abe. I'm Dr. Karras. I'm just going to have a little look. You feeling okay?
Been better.
Remember why you're here? You were legally dead, but lucky for you, modern medicine knows no limits.
I died?
Technically speaking, yes. You had an NDE.
I don't know what that is.
Near-death experience.
He's not a righteous guy. He's not a spooky guy. They just arbitrarily gave him that name. So his doctor...
Because there's also a Thing poster in Nathan Fillion's office, too.
There is. So his weirdo doctor, Dr. Karras, is the one to introduce him to the idea of people who have had a near-death experience and have seen the white light sometimes have, residual effects.
Nathan Fillion's like, what is that? And the doctor's like, it's an aura. It'll go away. And then I thought to myself, that's not normal. We don't talk like that normally. that's not something I want to hear from my doctor.
And there's something else, and you're going to think I'm crazy, but... I'm seeing and hearing all kinds of electrical stuff.
But, so the assumption is, Nathan Fillion's just, I don't know, now really good at recognizing special people. He doesn't know what it is.
Yeah, he's just like, oh, you're bright looking. But it's like when that doctor walks him down to his big EVP lab thing that he's... In my instant, that was like, oh, you're insane. Neat. That's cool, dude.
EVP stands for electronic voice phenomenon. Precognition, the white light you're seeing. All that stuff is part of the supernatural white noise that surrounds us. I've got a grant to study these paranormal types of things.
So EVP, what exactly is it?
It's the recording of voices and images of the deceased using a detuned receiving apparatus like a TV or a radio. Some people believe that EVP is the afterlife manifest all around us. Others think it's nothing more than a charge from our electromagnetic fields. And still others believe it's a means through which the dead can communicate with the living. Frankly, who knows? As long as we're not exactly sure what it is, they'll keep funding my grant.
And he talks about having this grant where they're condoning all this research and encouraging him to find concrete evidence.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, is Canada flush? I mean, their economy is doing very well.
Maybe there's paranormal, grants.
So we find out after Nathan Fillion's kind of released into the public that seeing the white light is actually a terrible thing.
Yeah, it's good. You don't want to be white lighted. You don't want to have the white light aura.
It's indicative of your imminent demise.
Right.
I guess Father Karras is the first person that he...
Not Father. He's a doctor in this.
Dr. Karras is the first person he... recognizes that, the aura is a sign that you're gonna die.
Right.
And then it takes on a whole different thing because at this point he's seen a bunch of people who had the aura around him and he's looking at dead people.
Yeah, but he kind of figures that out quick. Nathan Fillion, not a good scientist if all it takes is one for proof.
Did you notice that the office he works in, it looks like he manages a media lab in a college? It's so
I'm confused vague, on what
but he's
he
got
does.
A corner office.
Yeah, he's got the big office. He's got the Thing poster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm confused. What does he do? Do we know what he does?
I don't think we ever find out.
I don't care, really.
He's got a corner office in a college media lab. That's
fair enough.
As much information
he
as one could sort
He is running
of.
Up the AV club at the local community college.
Which is funny, that would have been useful to Michael Keaton in the first White Noise, but Nathan Fillion just kind of uses his own mental powers.
Yeah.
He doesn't really use technology.
He doesn't need to use the TV.
The spirits kind of announce themselves by taking over and sort of washing over any broadcast.
Which is irritating. Hey, I was watching that.
Yeah, but it's only happening to him, but yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't
I thought that
wild
I didn't
about
like that.
That.
I didn't like that effect. I didn't like anything about that.
Yeah, me neither.
Because I'm confused. Why does he need to see TV ghosts? All he needs to see is the glowing white light people.
Yeah, well, I mean, the ghosts are there for the jump scares.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Oh, okay, then.
But so, yeah, I don't know. At minute 22, I have a note, still bad.
Nice.
I've got a couple of those notes where I checked in just to sort of keep track of the time code.
I like when Nathan Fillion takes a baseball bat to his TV at one point because it's being crazy.
Right, TV. He doesn't like what's on it.
And I wrote, good jump scare. How you gonna explain your busted TV?
Yeah, well, now he lives alone.
Exactly.
when he tries, so the first person he tries to help is the homeless guy who's walking across the train tracks.
Right. Ooh.
And he sees the very, he can sort of estimate that the brighter the aura, the sooner they're going to die. And this guy is just a flash of light.
I did not ever get that while I was watching this. So
I think you might say it specifically because it came out of his mouth. You were just like, I don't care what you're saying. I hate you.
You tried to kill Buffy.
But so he runs down to save the guy because right. first his shopping cart gets stuck in the train tracks. And then just like in a cartoonish escalation,
yes.
then his foot gets stuck in the thing.
Which can be, how'd your foot get stuck there? Like, how did your foot get stuck under the tracks, dude?
It's almost like, yeah. I mean, this guy had a death wish. I mean, crossing train tracks in the first place. But so Nathan Fillion's hauling ass going to help the guy. And he's a couple seconds too late. And the homeless guy essentially explodes into a pile of vintage cans.
Yes, he turns into cans upon impact. And then cans go everywhere.
And they weren't even like soda cans, which is your standard like 5 cent return or in Canada,
these
maybe
are,
it's 15
old
cents.
Tin cans.
Right. They were like vintage.
Like old timey kind.
It was so conspicuous.
Maybe
that,
they're
like,
worth something. Maybe that guy was a can millionaire.
I was going to say, maybe he's not homeless at all. He's
exactly.
just a collector of vintage cans.
Exactly. And it's dirty work. So he was kind of dirty.
Hmm. Yeah, he's like a urban coal miner. He's
yeah. And if this is the Pacific Northwest, like when they pay like $5,000 for a knot, they will pay like a lot of money for a can.
Yeah, so at minute 34, I said, I'm sure glad Castle is a successful show.
I started also thinking of other things, too, while I was like, I wonder if my favorite band is going to be touring. I've been thinking about that a lot. When people are talking, I keep thinking about my favorite band. Then I quit. I quit entirely just making notes. I decided I'll just go along for the ride. That's where my notes stopped.
So after minute 34, Nathan Fillion tries to save the young guy who looks like a young Neil Gaiman.
Okay.
And so this guy is being roughed up by Canadian hooligans.
Yes, seems that way.
And Nathan Fillion recognized this happening on an overpass, this guy is blaring white light.
Who is that guy? Is that guy somebody?
I don't think so.
Familiar, right?
I think he's a Canadian actor. He looked like a younger version of the character Death on Supernatural, and he's also the first guy to get it in the movie Cube.
And he kind of looks like Michael Bolton from Office, a little.
Michael Bolton, weird coincidence, but the set designer for White Noise 1 was named Michael Bolton. Really,
we've come
random
full
there,
circle.
And I like
we should
to
get
think
points
that
for this. that was so non sequitur, ridiculous.
It was a mind meld moment. So the young Neil Gaiman looking guy, I wrote a note that I was being half serious, but the Canadian roughnecks who were pushing him around right. and like grabbing his girlfriend's ass. I wonder, like, do you think it's hard for Canadian actors to play angry?
I don't know.
Mean?
Yeah, because I thought they more
outside
than even
of a
hooligans.
Rink.
I thought they were like, I don't know, like a Russian mob. I don't know. For some reason to me that I was like, oh, they're like a Russian gang
yeah.
in Canada. I don't know. It made sense that they were like a Russian gang to me.
Okay. None of them spoke with the accents.
I know. But to me, like they looked kind of Russian. So in my mind, that was like organized Russian crime taking the streets of
But they were just
Vancouver.
Hooligans. They were just sexually harassing his girl and then showing like teaching him a lesson because he interfered.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. If you're
conspicuous
Canadian
in Canada,
I mean, maybe they watch American TV and they're like, I'm going to act like an American right now.
Like dicks.
I'm going to be rude.
Minute 44. My note is twisty, which is to say there's a twist.
Oh, nice.
This is when you start. This is the only point where the movie got like legitimately compelling, is when you find out that Nathan Fillion is, it's not enough to go save people who he sees are going to die.
Right,
he starts finding out that it was fated. It is kind of Final Destination-esque,
yes,
where
much so.
These people were meant to die. And he is interfering, and so things can go way worse than just the single person dying. And, you know, say, like, the guy who he helps who's going to get hit by a car because he's changing his tire.
The guy was kind of a dick. I mean, I might have let him get hit.
He was. And, again, like,
he, like,
Canadians aren't good at
all.
Playing angry.
No.
I mean, we love you, Canada, because you're a gentle people.
You're a gentle people.
So when that guy gets saved, he goes on to like kill a bunch more people.
Yeah.
And yeah. So when Nathan Fillion realizes like, well, now he's got a real dilemma because he has the opportunity to save these people, but it might just be fate to let them die. And you know, the movie is interesting for about 15 minutes when you're kind of playing on that idea.
Yes. And then comes Bible math, right?
Yeah, well,
the section you dubbed Bible math.
When he's looking at his home videos, his kid, they didn't really play this up in the beginning, but at the diner table where his family is executed, there is actually a video camera.
Right.
And the point is that his son kind of
loves
tapes everything.
Videotape things, yeah.
And so in watching his old family movies, there's a video where he's not in the car, but him and his wife and his son are at a traffic light, and the son's just, you know, they're chatting it up. And a stranger stops them from going into an intersection and getting hit by a truck.
Right. Are you all right?
I'm okay, Mom. That man saved your life.
Thank you!
That's a run.
And the stranger is the same guy who killed his family.
Dun, dun, dun!
So he knows the guy's name because, you know, the tragic incident in the diner, and he looks him up, and it turns out that guy didn't die when he tried to kill himself.
I thought that was weird.
I saw him.
That he put a gun in his mouth and didn't kill himself.
No, not that he didn't die. I thought it was weird that Nathan Fillion wouldn't know that
dude survived.
The guy was still alive, because the guy would have had to gone to trial, and Nathan Fillion was there as a witness, and I can't imagine that they wouldn't call Nathan Fillion.
You know what? That's a big plot hole.
Press wouldn't contact Nathan Fillion, or I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. He would never not know that the guy who killed his wife and son
wasn't dead. Important point that they seem to have fucked up.
Right?
Yeah, that's a big
plot
hole.
The whole time I'm thinking, like, how come he didn't? This doesn't make any sense. He doesn't know this at all.
Although that said, when I heard the news, I got giddy with excitement because this guy tried to kill himself by putting a gun in his mouth. And I was like, there's going to be some pretty cool prosthetics coming up.
This is going to be gross.
I betcha. And so when Nathan Fillion does go to see this nutbag in the, you know, mental hospital, they first frame him where you're only seeing half his face.
Right.
And I was like, I can't wait to see the other
half. But I was kind of disappointed when he turned.
Really?
Yeah. I was kind of, you know why? Because American Horror Story Freak Show.
Yeah.
To me, like, that was one of the best shotgun to the face, you know, kind of.
I haven't gotten to that yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Well,
it'll still be surprising when you see it. It'll
very
still
strange
be
thing to look forward to. But so when they do show this guy's face, I was impressed.
Well, he had teeth in there. There was a lot. There was a lot of things not good with that. His teeth would have been like pieced out. His teeth would not have continued to be in his mouth.
Well, one side of his face is like clearly supported by like wires and metal.
But there's all a bunch of teeth in there. There wouldn't be.
Okay. I guess they could only do so much. But I was
impressed. I want more realism in my white noise to the light. Or into the whatever the fuck it's called.
So this nut job doesn't say much except that he's not supposed to save these people, and there's a 3-day cycle.
The dead will haunt you until you put right what you've done. If you save, you must kill. Trial error.
Yeah, but he's not helpful. You'd think he'd be also more helpful.
He seemed to be a crazy person.
Yeah.
I'm not that surprised he wasn't helpful.
Fair enough then.
So he only winds up in the mental hospital because the guy's wife announces that
he's not dead.
He didn't die after.
The guy's wife who also lets. Okay, so this guy's wife, her husband killed his family. she's letting Nathan Fillion, the husband of the family that her husband killed, just be in a room alone in her giant, giant house.
Yeah, well, she does say she feels incredibly guilty, and she's so sorry.
But if I was her, I would be afraid, like, Nathan Fillion would kill the wife and son.
I would be, yeah. I mean, that she doesn't... Again, maybe it's Canada. Maybe she's giving them the benefit of the doubt. I'd be a little concerned, like, I'm going to stay in the room with you to make sure you don't of burn course. My house down out of, you know, revenge.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, maybe that's an American thing. I don't know.
Yeah. So in his things, he finds, like, Bible stuff. Like, there's all sort of conjecture in terms of, like, the angel of death and sort of death itself
and
being a fate.
And obsessed with the upside down cross, which has actually nothing to do with Satan. It's really absurd. It irritates me. Anyone who makes a movie should fucking know that. Like, it really bothers me. It really bothers me so much. But anyway, they're obsessed so much cross stuff.
I think he finds, was it my imagination or does he find a fortune cookie message that says.
There was a fortune cookie message, yes.
All right. So, I mean, it's an old retreaded Buddhist idea, but that you are responsible for any life you save.
In bed.
What?
You know how you're supposed to write, say in bed after? I thought that was the Buddhist thing you were going to, how you
had
in bed.
Oh, for fortune cookies?
Yeah. You always had in bed. Now I've given that to you. Now you can do that.
And I will pay it forward.
In bed.
So everything from, like, Bibles to fortune cookies, and now he's sort of getting a bigger sense of the picture. And he goes into a weird, like, montage moment of Bible math.
Oh,
where
my God.
He
and then
it's,
like, doubled up with that guy when he was discovering shit.
Yeah. And he's extrapolating to, like, the Greek alphabet and figuring out that, like, it's just, I don't know. It's Mad Libs. It's Bible Mad Libs that goes to some bizarre place. And he realizes that he shouldn't be saving people. And if anything, he feels that he should be the angel of death. Yeah. Instead. Which, yeah, the movie fucking falls apart fast when they start cramming these ideas.
When the guy who looks like Michael Bolton from Office Space, when he when his scene comes up, when he starts to go on his little killing rampage.
Yeah. He's a pianist in a fancy hotel.
And so he starts playing, like, crazy piano music with tritones. And he's just like, tritones, tritones. And then my husband and I were just like, wow, he's, like, really playing the shit out of some tritones. You know he's really aggravated.
That's funny.
Like, anything better would be, like, sevenths or something. So he's playing these, like, tritones. But then it was awesome to see a piano fall and smash a bunch of people. That was insane. That was like
a
cartoon
real
come to life.
Yeah. And I thought there were a couple times in the movie where they clearly spent a lot of money for, you know, whether it was a car crash or what have you. Any moment where they spend a lot of money, they film it with four cameras and in slow motion. They're just like, you are going to see every penny of this on camera.
Exactly. We have spent a lot of money. This is what we're going to do. Want to make sure you really see it. But I loved that piano smash, actually.
It was pretty wild. And that he, you know, you think he saves the day, but again, like, fate intervenes. Nope. And no, we are going to have our bodies.
I don't think you should have saved me.
Another point, at 1 hour and 30 minutes, the movie is still going. Just, it's devolved into a hot mess.
Nice.
Yeah. I really hated the ending. His ability to problem solve doesn't really go very far. Like, he just kind of accepts his fate that, like, oh, I shouldn't be saving people. I should be killing them.
Right.
And now, like, we're just now on this ride where he's...
And then there's another person who, and I don't want to give the ending away, but another person who accepts this as fact, even though this is really, three is not a lot to prove a fact, you know? And this other person is like, you know what? This is true. And I'm going to go along with this ride as well. Like, that's not, I don't know what, you know, what is that scientific theory or, you know, where you have hypothesis and this and that.
Okay.
And there's, like, a rule you should follow. No rules have been followed. So we can't accept this as fact or even theory.
No.
This is supposition. Stupid, stupid supposition. And at this point in time, I'm still wondering, like, are the Tossers going to tour back in New York again? That's pretty much what I'm thinking.
Yeah. So every problem in the movie is attempted to be wrapped up with CG and ghost montage. Just every character we've encountered throughout the movie makes a sort of ghost reappearance. I hated the ending. I mean, as bad as the movie is, the ending is one of the worst parts about it.
Yes.
And you have to wait an hour and 35 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
Ugh.
No, yeah. It was not great.
So that was White Noise 2, The Light. I would say turn it off.
Yes, exactly. Turn off the light. Easy. Click, clack.
Yeah, the first one was worth watching, but that fizzled out. So this was our adventure into electronic voice phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I would like to say that I learned something, but I feel like I didn't. I mean, one of the only things I thought was interesting that I learned was that people were so into EVP and people were so into talking to the dead and stuff in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Sure, and like the seance.
Yeah, people
style.
Were obsessed with that, and so obsessed that actually Scientific American asked Thomas Edison a question about EVP. And so to me, like, okay, well, at least I learned something. I learned that, because that's pretty fucking cool that people thought so much, or that thought that there was some validity, scientific validity to this. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah. I'm on the side of Houdini. Everybody knows him as the magician, but like, he exposed a lot of frauds and guys who swore they were contacting the afterlife and whatever seances and over shaky tables and shit like that. So yeah, I don't know. We gave it a shot. We legitimately went into this with an open mind, but we did not find anything. No contact from Eileen.
No.
May she rest in peace, I guess.
Still unsolved. The case is still unsolved to this day.
Yeah, and we'll put up visuals on the website of the actual poster, you know, offering a reward for any information, because pretty creepy.
It was pretty amazing to see those on my walk home when they were posted.
Yeah.
You know, because then my husband was like, did you see these? And I said, yeah, of course I saw this. He said, did you read the address? And I was like, no. And he's like, read the address. And I was like, oh my God, that's where I live.
Yeah. Not anymore, thankfully.
No, not anymore.
Mindy's
please don't stalk
relocated
me there.
To the city. So nice. They named it twice. Okay. So you've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at Fangoria.com. So that's it for this episode. This is me, Darren, signing off.
And I'm Mindy.
Rate us 5 stars. Give us a review at iTunes.
5 stars.
And check us out on Facebook, Twitter.
Review the podcast.
And be sure to check out our website, therantsmacabre.com.